This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Susan Harbidge Page has been a border crosser since she was a child. At a young age, she traveled around Europe with her family in a Volkswagen bus. Later, she worked in Palestine, crossing borders from Israel to the occupied territories. And most recently, she's been taking photos at the U.S.-Mexican border. She travels those liminal spaces that often divide the haves from the have-nots. Susan's current exhibit is called Borderlands, Evidence from the Rio Grande. It's a collection of photos and objects on view at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at NC State University through the end of July. Susan Harbidge Page is a photographer, artist, and a professor of women's and gender studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Susan, welcome back. It's been too long.
Hi, Frank. Thanks to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Talk about, let's talk about your travels. I want to talk more about this exhibit, but you really did start traveling in this VW bus across Europe, right?
Yes. In 1969, when I was 10, my mom packed me and my three older sisters into a red Volkswagen van, and we did this amazing camping trip in Europe for 3 months, and we did all the traditional tourist things and went to lots of churches and lots of museums. Paris and London and Florence and Rome. And then my mom did this extraordinary thing. She found out that the Iron Curtain countries were open. And this was 1969. And so we drove into Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Turkey.
Those are some border crossings. I guess you'd have a few stories about getting across those. But even though it was open to you, it probably wasn't easy to get across.
No, we were very much an anomaly, especially traveling without a male in the car. And at 10, it was really, really interesting because a border is a line in the earth. And on one side, there were 18-year-olds with guns. And on the other side, there were 18-year-olds with guns. And there were these pieces of wood painted red and white that went up and down as you passed. And at 10, I learned that on one side you spoke one language, on another side you spoke a different language. The stores were full on one side, you ate great food on one side, and on another side of that border, you just crossed the line and the stores would be empty. People would be coming up to touch my hair because they hadn't seen anybody who had blonde hair. I had blonde hair back then. They hadn't seen the kind of material I was wearing, the fabric I was wearing. So we really were very much outsiders at that time. And it really did make me learn, on this side of the border, you have electricity. On this side of the border, you heat your house with wood. Just very, very different ideas of access to wealth.
Yeah, and then later you worked in Palestine again, crossing these borders between Israel and the occupied territories.
I did. Yeah, that was a very powerful experience for me. The first day I got there, I was taken on a bus out into the Negev Desert, and I could just see this whole community of Bedouin who were just living out in the desert, and they didn't have access to water. They didn't have schools. There was very much this separation between the Israeli communities and the Bedouins, who were actually Israeli citizens. So this very much marginalized community. And I just kept saying, what's going on here? What's this? I was just always asking questions. I got my first camera when I was 10, and I've been asking questions with my camera for a really, really long time.
Well, tell us about the questions you ask and perhaps answer for yourself in Borderlands.
Well, my work is always something I'm trying to figure out. And I've been trying to figure out borders for a really long time. On that trip, I'm just going to go back one second. On that trip when I was 10, one of the things that happened was we were held and detained going into Romania. And it was night, and we were locked in a room. There were no cell phones. There were no computers. There were guys with guns. We didn't know what was happening. They took every single thing out of our car. They sprayed off the bottom of our car with water. It was this idea of I had freely crossed 22 borders, and then all of a sudden, here I was in the middle of these two countries, and I didn't belong to either one. So it was, for me at 10, that was a really powerful experience. So moving forward to my work on the border, it really is about trying to figure things out. I first self-funded a trip to the border in 2007 when I heard this statistic on the radio, and it was that 20% more women and children than men die crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And I just thought, well, why is that? What's going on? And I just wanted to see for myself. So I had actually been to that area in 1996 working, and so I knew that area a little bit. And so I just got on a plane and went down and started walking the border. And I all of a sudden started seeing these strange objects as I walked and canoed and rode bikes. And it's really strange when you're walking along and you see a red bra, when you see a toothbrush, when you see someone's underwear, when you see a Bible, when you see a religious card, you know, it's overwhelming. And I just remember looking at those things on the border and thinking, why are these things here? And I knew that they were telling a story. And I knew that there was a story about people risking their lives to come to the United States so that they could have a security for their family and good health care and work. At the time when I started, for every dollar you made in Mexico, for every hour of work, if you made $10 here, it was a dollar in Mexico. So I think most people just want to take care of their families. And I knew that's what was happening. But I also wanted to know why some people have to risk their lives to have it, and why other people's just have it, have this right. So anyways, at the beginning, I started, I wanted to ask questions about this. And I was also thinking about representation, because I am a white woman. I'm an older white woman. I've always had a U.S. passport. I'm privileged. So I just promised myself from the very beginning when I started that I wouldn't photograph people who were crossing the border. The media has plenty of that. Mm. I'm not interested in that. I wanted to find another way to humanize what was happening on the border. And so I started collecting those objects that I found. And I also always put my camera down when I see someone crossing the border. I have never photographed people. I've seen lots of people being picked up and taken to detention centers, but I don't photograph them. I just think, why would I want to photograph someone at this most vulnerable point in their life? But I do think it's important to do it, because I think it is a witnessing, and this is my nation state, and I care what happens on our border, and it is very much an occupied territory. And I've seen over the years the increasing militarization. When I lived in Palestine and Israel, I was often stopped, and there were checkpoints, and I was interrogated. And more and more, that is what our U.S.-Mexico border feels like and looks like. It's just, it's occupied territory now. And I think that's part of the reason I started doing this work. In 2007, and I think still we have the fastest growing Latino population in the United States, and most of us will never go to the border. Most people in North Carolina don't even have a passport. So it's this imaginary place, and we don't know what's happening there. So my work is sort of a way to go and walk the border and photograph the paths and the building of the wall, and then all of these objects that have been left by people who swim across the border and, come into the United States. One of the most powerful things for me in my sort of process of understanding this, what's happening, was around 2000, I started teaching ESL classes to adult ESL learners. And we were using photography. But one of the things we did was we had people map their journeys. And I was astounded. I had no idea that people, you come from Honduras, and then you cross the border three times, and then you might end up in Ohio, and then you end up in Seattle, and then you come to North Carolina. I just had no idea. And at that time, I also confronted, a lot of my stereotypes about, everyone's Mexican, my stereotypes about, you just come here and you get a job. No, it's really hard. You come here, you get a job. you have to figure out how to get health care for your kids. You're in a car that maybe you don't have a driver's license for. You're always living in fear. You become isolated. You actually do have your own community. So I don't know. I just learned a lot at that moment.
So what do you do? Talk about the objects that you photograph, because again, as you said, you're not going to photograph people. There are all of these streams, ideological, national, cultural, that are flowing along with these individuals. But all you're left with is a toothbrush or a wallet or a bra. And what do you see? How do you frame it? You know, what do you bring then to the camera to try to tell a story through these objects?
Well, I've made this... I want to talk about some of the individual objects, but I have collected about 1,000 objects, and they are part of the Anti-Archive of Trauma on the U.S.-Mexico border. And my collecting of these objects is not only my desire to humanize the journeys and individualize these journeys, but to also save a history that I don't think has been saved and looked at. We have Ellis Island.
Well, you call it an anti-archive.
I call it the anti-archive because most of our archives save the things from people who are rich and famous, people who have money, people who can store their stuff in the attic. But what most people think that the border is full of trash, and it's only when you look at it and you see what it is that you realize this is not trash, but it's telling a very important story of a northern migration. But, you know, like when I found Alex Ramirez Cuba's wallet on this side of the border, wet, because he had just thrown it out so he could hopefully stay in the United States, it's an astounding moment. There was this young man who was 18. There was his photo, his passport, the numbers of Roje Blanca that he would have called when he got to the U.S. He was throwing out his identity to remain here in a space, you know, where I use my identity to actually be on the border. And that wet wallet was so profound for me. My son was 18, and so I saw it, of course, from the viewpoint of a mother, but I just couldn't imagine what it would mean to have your son leave home at 18 and make this trek north. And I don't know what happened to him, but I do know he threw his wallet away probably so that if he did get picked up and detained, mm-hmm. he wouldn't be sent back to Honduras, but would have just been sent back across the border to Matamoros. So there are lots of things. Like if you find a toothbrush, I just think, you know, Frank, you're never going to see my toothbrush. It's a very intimate object. You know, right. Other people don't see it. So what is it doing in the ground? You know, it's an object of self-care. It's an object, you know, it's a very, very personal object. And, you know, why is it on the ground on this path along the border, along the Rio Grande? Well, it's there, I know, because the Border Patrol sees it as a weapon. And it means someone's been picked up and detained because it's short and hard. You know, I'll never forget the time that I went to Hidalgo and I would just walk for a mile and I must have seen 40 pairs of shoelaces. You know something's wrong when you see 40 pairs of shoelaces near the river. That means people are getting picked up. That means that their shoelaces have been taken away by the Border Patrol because they know they take their shoelaces away so that they don't kill themselves they don't commit suicide with those shoelaces when they're picked up. So there are these ordinary objects, but they are extraordinarily...
Well, intimate apparel as well. Yeah. Bras tell often a very, very sad and tragic story,
I have found many, many bras on the border, and it is said that a coyote, a human trafficker, leaves a bra on the border as a sign that they have raped and brutalized a woman. And, you know, that is a big part of why I started doing this work, just to see... what was happening to women. I started talking to immigration lawyers early on, and Rogelio Nunez told me, you know, 50% of my cases involve violence against women, But in reality, I think 99% of women who come north experience some sort of sexual assault or vulnerability. And, you know, the migration is a lot based on a labor market. And what happened early on was men came and the border was very blurry, and men would come and they would work and then they would go back home to their families. And then as we have hardened the borders, people couldn't go back and forth. So then there are more women coming by themselves with their kids, and they're just more vulnerable. If a baby cries, a coyote will leave you behind. You know, and they pay for their on one hand, they're extraordinarily resilient and they're so courageous and they're powerful and they are resisting and they are making a better life. They are life givers and life makers. But on the other hand, they're so vulnerable that, you know, they are being taken advantage of. And I can tell you that I have done many, I have listened to many stories of people who come north, and there's a lot of violence that takes place on the border, on the journey, and also here in North Carolina arrive.
It just tells you what power there is in creating this border and maintaining it, and the power even to shape identities. Mm-hmm. The fact that you have to shed your identity when you come here, and even what it's done to the identities of vulnerable Americans who are so fearful, who have so little in the way of their own identity, that they fear people from other places. Mm-hmm. Think about the depths of the fear that you would have to experience to come up with anything as maniacal and some of the policies that we are seeing perpetrated in the names of Americans who are so fearful they've lost their minds because their own identities are challenged in ways that are almost sort of incomprehensible. You say, what are you afraid of? But that's the power of the border, isn't it?
Yeah. And the thing that I want this exhibition to do is I want the viewer, I want you, when you come to this exhibition at the Gregg Museum of Art, to ask yourself, when you see all of those objects in the middle of the exhibition, what would it take for me to put my toothbrush and my underwear and my T-shirt and my Bible or whatever you're going to take with you, your iPhone, in the back of your backpack and leave home and take your child across a river at night, you might not swim, you know, in hopes of a better life, in hopes of finding something better for your family and being able to take care of them. I think that, for me, is the question that we don't reflect on enough is, you know, it's so hard for us to imagine that. But I think we should. I think we should ask. And I also hope that these objects really rehumanize this story, because I think the media, it's just so relentless now, as you said, that we forget the individual stories. We forget the mother who's combing her daughter's hair every morning. We forget the mother who's putting on some eyeshadow so she can fit in and move into the United States.
Susan Harbidge Page is an artist, a photographer, and a professor of women's and gender studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Thanks so much for being here, Susan.
Thank you, Frank.
Her exhibit, Borderlands, Evidence from the Rio Grande, is on view at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design at North Carolina State University, and it will be there through the end of July. And, of course, as always, you can check with our website, stateofthings.org, for more details. Just ahead, a hero's journey into death, resurrection, and redemption through poetry. Stay tuned.